2 years after a young man was hit and killed by a Cincinnati police cruiser, his family files suit, but not against the police. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, are there echoes of the Kyle Plush case? Then why multiple cars have plunged into Mill Creek, why HHS is accusing Ohio hospitals of insurance fraud, and why two Ohio lawmakers are taking aim at flock cameras. Joining me now to get the news review started are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporters Cameron Knight and David Ferraro. Welcome back, everybody.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks.
Happy to be here.
Cameron, tell us about the 2024 police crash at the center of this lawsuit filed this week.
So 19-year-old Amir Johnson was coming home from work.
Amir Jordan.
was coming home from work. He got off a Metro bus on SD Avenue in Spring Grove Village. He began to cross the street, and he was struck by a police cruiser that was traveling quickly with lights and sirens on. The officer, according to this lawsuit, the officer believed he was responding to a top priority shooting where there could be people injured, there could be a shooter on the scene. The officer didn't know the specifics, but that's what they believed they were responding to. The lawsuit alleges that this situation was not a top priority shooting, that it was a property damage report where a gun was fired accidentally, nobody was hurt. And the person just wanted to file a, you know, property damage report. The lawsuit also alleges that the dispatchers made a mistake. And while they had about 5 minutes to slow all the officers down, they failed to do that. And that's really the crux of the lawsuit. And through other backgrounding and documents that these lawyers have obtained, they say they have found that this is an ongoing problem that's been happening for years at the Emergency Communications Center, which is Cincinnati's 911 center.
Okay.
And that they that the leadership there has not only failed to fix it, but is concealing the problems.
Well, we will get into a lot of those specifics. Here's how Amir's grandmother, here's how Amir's grandmother, Paula McClendon, describes him.
He was loving. He was very compassionate. And also in our household was is my great-grandson that has autism. Amir was his buddy. He was his only friend. And Amir would say, if grandma and grandpa and papa get on your nerve, come on up to my room. We can talk. We can play games. That's the type of person Amir was.
Can hear the love in her voice for her grandson. Becca, as I mentioned, the family's not suing the police department.
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit more about the why they're suing and who they're suing?
Yeah. So, you know, as Cameron explained, the actual cause of Amir's death was a police officer driving his cruiser at high speed to get to a situation. But they're saying that that police officer followed policy and did what he was trained to do. So they place the blame solely on the Emergency Communication Center. So the lawsuit itself names the city. It also names several individuals, including the person who took the 911 call, the dispatcher who looked at the notes of that 911 call as they were coming in real time and dispatched the officers to the scene. Also a supervisor who they say knew about problems with misclassified calls for a long time, a deputy director of the department who they similarly say knew about these problems, and the director of the Emergency Communication Center. It also named City Manager Cheryl Long. Now, interestingly, one of the things they said is, you know, according to the documents that they provided in the complaint, which include emails that of people notifying the Emergency Communication Center leadership about other instances of misclassified calls. In those cases, they didn't result in loss of life or things like this. So they say, you know, the attorneys say, we know what the director knew. We know what the deputy director knew. We know what the supervisor knew. They say, we don't know what went up the chain further than that. We don't know what Cheryl Long knew. But she does have, you know, in the chain of command is the manager over the Emergency Communication Center. And so that's why she's named in the lawsuit.
Becca, did the family's lawyer explain why the police department wasn't part of the lawsuit? Is it because, as they say, you know, they say this officer was following protocol?
Yes, and that's in his words. And this specific attorney, Zach Gottesman, you know, said and has, you know, a history of representing police officers and other first responders in court. You know, he even says that that is the reason that this case came to his attention is because he was vague on the details, did not, you know, was asked directly, you know, did the police officers involved in this case come to you? And he, you know, kind of demurred and said no, but that many officers had used this case, so this circumstance, as an example of what he says they believe is a chronic problem of these misclassified calls. Interesting to note, though, you know, we don't know what kind of investigation, if any, went into what happened there. We don't know if the police department did an internal investigation with the police officer. We don't know for sure that the police officer was following a procedure. Those are questions that are unanswered because they're not addressed in the lawsuit.
Cameron, you mentioned that this lawsuit is alleging that this problem is part of a pattern. What leads them to believe that?
So there was a series of emails that these lawyers got a hold of where they had there had been another misclassification of calls. And in this email back and forth, there's discussion of gun runs, which are like any kind of situation involving a gun. The email thread sort of talks about it being those are being classified as the top priority, no matter what the circumstances are. And there were kind of concerns going back and forth about whether like that could cause problems. The concern with classifying everything as a high priority call is that police departments across the country are very well aware that high-speed responses are very dangerous, not only to civilians who might get injured, like Amir, but also to other first responders, to the police themselves who are having to do these maneuvers in traffic. They know they're dangerous. It's a known kind of thing. So the police officers, again, according to this lawyer, had been raising concerns about it.
Mm-hmm. Cameron, this lawsuit will remind some of our listeners of the death of Kyle Plush in 2018. Can you just briefly remind us what happened to him?
Yeah, so Kyle Plush was trapped in the back of a Honda minivan. He was trying to retrieve some things from the back of the vehicle, kind of from the back seat, sort of. And while he was doing that, the seats collapsed in a way that trapped him. And he was able to use voice calling using either his phone or an Apple Watch or something like a Siri type of service to call 911 more than once. And the police were dispatched to the area, but they never found him. Mm-hmm. They did not find him in time. And his family sued the city over this situation and called for drastic reforms to the Emergency Communications Center at that point. And there was a multi-million dollar settlement paid to that family. And the city agreed to 5 years of oversight, independent expert oversight of the center. And this crash with Amir happened during that period of oversight.
Mm. Becca, what do we know about that oversight? I mean, do we have much details about what that entailed, what that should mean for what's happening at the Emergency Communications Center?
Yeah, it was a 5-year reform plan in which a committee basically of three people acted as advisors for some of these reforms. There's one in particular that went into effect in March 2021 that is specifically cited in this lawsuit, and that's what is supposed to happen is the creation of these agency liability reports. And this is a report paired with kind of an internal investigation that's supposed to happen anytime there's an incident in which, and this is a direct quote, an employee allegedly performed in a manner that created an increased likeliness of death or injury to persons or significant loss of property. So these are documents that are supposed to be, you know, recorded and produced in reports annually and looked at carefully. The attorneys in this lawsuit say that they put in a public records request for all of the agency liability reports from March 2021 when it went into effect through December 2024. What they got back was just one internal investigation related to an EMS call, a medical situation, nothing related to police calls that were miscoded. They say that there are a few examples that they provide evidence of that they believe qualify for, that should have had an agency liability report. It's not clear to me, based on the documentation they provided, whether those misclassified calls do rise to the level of, you know, an increased likeliness of death or injury or significant loss of property. However, this situation with Amir Jordan, I think very clearly would meet that definition. And there was no agency liability report created for that situation. And what they're saying is, you know, we know that that's one that should have been there. It's unclear how many, if there are others that, you know, there's no way of knowing because it wasn't documented in the way that is outlined in the standard procedures.
Mm. Well, Amir's grandmother also talked about how his death is affecting her.
We not only lost Amir, but we lost my husband in between this grief process. And my husband took his life a year and 1 week after Amir's death. It has been a nightmare. I suffer with anxiety, panic attacks, just breakdowns. I mean, the real joy in my life has been taken away. That's Amir and my husband. We had 48 years together. So my life a lot of times just feel empty.
Becca, what is this lawsuit filed by Amir's family? What is it seeking?
Well, there are six claims for relief in the lawsuit, including wrongful death, also conscious pain and suffering, wanton and or reckless misclassification, a few other things. And what they're looking for is a jury trial to rule on whether those things are accurate and then damages as a result of that. So they're looking for compensatory damages. They would not name an exact amount. I think Cameron actually was the one who asked, you know, what are you looking for, a specific number? And they said no, but the lawsuit says it would be at least $25,000. They also are looking for accountability. So they're requesting court-supervised reforms to the emergency communications call prioritization, classification, and dispatch, references to those agency liability reports I mentioned earlier. A lot of the same demands that were made in the Kyle Plush case that ended in a settlement. They did say they are open to a settlement with the city. They did not have discussions with the city about a settlement prior to filing the lawsuit, but the attorney said that was primarily because the statute of limitations is 2 years and that deadline is coming up very soon. They said they had to file, but they are open to those negotiations with the city.
Cameron, has the city responded to this lawsuit at all?
They have not. I reached out to them a few times. They have a policy where they just don't respond to ongoing litigation. Sometimes they'll offer sort of thoughts on the side of the litigation, but in this case, they have not done that.
Okay. Well, last Saturday, there was a fatal car crash, this one into the Mill Creek. David, tell us what happened.
Yeah, so last Saturday, as you said, Lucy, another tragedy over in Mill Creek. There was a car with five occupants that was going down Queen City Avenue. And if you're familiar with the Western Hills Viaduct and familiar with that west side sort of interchange there, when you get off of the viaduct and you go onto Queen City Avenue, you can actually go straight or go to the right instead of going westbound, and you can end up in a dead end. And this car drove through the dead end, ended up striking through a guardrail and plunging into the Mill Creek. There were five passengers in the car and only one survived.
Oh, and this is not the first time a car has gone into the Mill Creek there, right?
It's not. So I looked into it and I found that there were at least five other crashes where cars had driven into the creek. And it seems like this dead end is a particular problem point that both in the data, it shows that there's multiple crashes where people are going off the edge, either striking the guardrail. One person struck the guardrail and stopped, but four others struck the guardrail and ran through. And then it seems like the city has identified this as a problem spot as well.
Has that part of Queen City Avenue been redesigned recently?
It has. So anyone on the west side probably remembers the sewer project about 2019, 2020, pre-COVID. So there was a sewer project, MSD built out Lick Run. As they did that, Queen City Avenue, which used to just be one way going westbound, ended up adding a little mini segment that goes in both directions. So now when you get off the viaduct, right, you can either go to the left and go towards Queen City Avenue, heading towards the west side, or you can go towards State Avenue and going to the right. And what that did is that added a straight lane that actually, if you just keep going straight, it brings you right down the dead end straight into the creek.
So is the concern that that design could be confusing to drivers? I mean, what have Cincinnati police said about the cause of these crashes?
So Cincinnati police, when it comes to the crash this past weekend, still investigating whether impairment or excessive speed might have been a factor. But looking at the other crashes, they've said that, you know, drivers lost control of their vehicle, as would be expected when, you know, going into the creek and such like that and flipping over. But have been looking at different things, excessive speed, impairment in some cases, distracted driving in others. But it does seem as to be the case that there's some possibilities for additional safety measures onto that road, maybe a more robust guardrail, additional signage. And when I spoke with the city's transportation engineering department, they said they're looking into what they can do to beef that up.
What are some of the things that they could do? Are there like short-term things that they could do that they think might kind of address this problem?
Well, right now, you got a straight guardrail at the end of that dead end. And if you think when you're driving on the highway and there's guardrails on the side, even if you do wreck on the highway, you're kind of hitting at an angle. But this guardrail is the same kind that you would see on the edge of a highway. But in this case, you'd be hitting it straight on. And I wasn't able to get in touch with a traffic expert, and I'm not one myself, but just doing a little research, you know, there's a difference in what different levels of guardrails are rated for speed impacts and stuff like that. Without getting into the nitty gritty, of course, they could get to a more robust guardrail or some sort of New Jersey barrier that might be able to withstand the crash. It seems like this past weekend, the car was able to go right through the guardrail and take it out, and other crashes the same as well. So that's something the city said that they're considering. Also, there's right now only one sign that says no outlet when you're going into the dead end. So some additional signage or lights that indicate, hey, this road is ending. This isn't just continuation of Queen City Avenue. If you're trying to go down to State, you had to turn right back behind you. That's something that's on the table as well.
Yeah. Have you heard anything from anybody about whether there could be lawsuits in this case? I know this is very early, but is that anything that might be a possibility?
I haven't. Yeah, I know that the police are still investigating, and that they still have. I was actually just talking with the police department this morning, and they're still conducting interviews and talking with witnesses, and also the sole survivor of the crash. In that case as well, I understand that the family member of that one survivor had mentioned how while she was injured and all that, she's also incredibly traumatized from this whole incident. The car had flipped over, and she ended up being able to get to one part of the car that wasn't submerged in the water, and then was waving to that nearby viaduct to try and flag cars down, ask for help for an hour before somebody on a bus saw and was able to help her out.
Oh my gosh. So did this happen during daylight hours or nighttime hours?
Yeah, about 6 p.m. last Saturday.
Wow, okay. Well, is there any more work that could be done at this spot more long-term? Are they talking about any long-term changes here?
Well, again, Westsiders know Western Hills Viaduct is on the docket for repairs within the next 5 to 10 years. And it's possible that when they do the repairs and adjust maybe the sort of outtake for how people get off the viaduct and how that all those interchanges look between State Avenue and Queen City Avenue, that there might be some changes that might eliminate that straight lane into the dead end altogether.
Yeah. Okay, well, I know you will be staying on top of that. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporters David Ferrara and Cameron Knight, and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks so much.
Up next, why is HHS accusing several Ohio hospitals of insurance fraud? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The federal government is accusing children's hospitals and healthcare providers of insurance fraud, including several hospitals in Ohio. Joining me now to explain is Cincinnati Enquirer, Health and Environment Enterprise reporter, Esther Lonstein. Welcome back, Esther.
Thanks for having me again, Lucy May.
It's great to have you. Esther, what are the accusations in this report from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services?
Yeah, so the claim at the heart of this report is really that these doctors and hospitals are pushing gender-affirming care on minors and their families in order to make money. So the providers are allegedly doing this by convincing the patients that they need this care, and then to make sure they profit, they're using inaccurate diagnostic billing codes in order to get reimbursement.
Huh. Which hospitals in Ohio were listed in the report?
Yeah, so there were a few. Nationwide Children's in Columbus, Cincinnati Children's, Dayton Children's, and Akron Children's Hospitals, along with a couple Planned Parenthood locations. So Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio and the Planned Parenthood Southwest Ohio region are also listed.
How much alleged insurance fraud is this report talking about, and over how much time is it talking about?
Yeah, so this report draws from records between the years of 2015 and 2025, so about a decade, and it's alleging that there's about $60 million worth of fraud.
Okay. And you mentioned that there's the report saying that people use the wrong insurance codes, or can you talk a little bit more about the specifics of all that?
Yeah, absolutely. So all of the hospitals in Ohio that I listed are accused of misusing diagnostic codes, for more specifically the diagnostic code around endocrine disorder, the unspecified variety, in order to provide puberty blockers for kids between the ages of 13 and 17, I believe was the age range, or 9 to 17, my apologies. And the accusation there is that the typical reasons for prescribing puberty blockers for unspecified endocrine diagnosis is usually coupled with a gender-related diagnosis or a diagnosis of precocious puberty, which is when puberty starts early. And these specific cases, there was no supplemental diagnosis.
Okay, so that was the only thing referenced in the information.
Correct. The unspecified endocrine disorder was the only diagnosis listed.
Okay. Have any of the hospitals that you mentioned responded to these allegations?
Yeah, so I worked with Sam Hendrickson from the Columbus Dispatch on this story, and she reached out to Nationwide Children's and did not receive a response from them. I reached out to Dayton Children's and Akron Children's and did not receive a response from either of those. Cincinnati Children's did say that they were reading the report, but they were not willing to offer further comment on it. And the Planned Parenthoods did offer comment and basically denied that they provide gender-affirming care to minors, which is illegal in Ohio, and called it, quote, a false attack.
Hmm. So you wrote that an Ohio lobbying organization contributed to this report. Tell us about that organization. What's that all about?
Yeah. So the president of the Center for Christian Virtue, Aaron Baer, contributed largely to the report. And that organization is a religious kind of conservative lobbying organization that advocates for policy that is more in line with their religious views. So they also advocate for anti-abortion policy.
Hmm. Okay. And is it clear what they had to do with the report?
I do not know. From what I read, the report didn't specify. It just said that they were a contributor.
Gotcha. Okay. And I Vice President J.D. Vance has posted about this report on social media. What did he have to say about all this?
Yeah. So he basically praised the report, which is called Wolves in White Coats, How Doctors and Hospitals Pushed and Profited from the Fraud of, quote, Gender Medicine. He posted in a video on X saying that it turns out that convincing vulnerable children to reject their gender can create patients for life, earning hospitals tens of thousands of dollars in additional revenue per child. So essentially he's saying that doctors coerce these children into gender-affirming care and create, quote, captive patients, where they benefit financially from gender-affirming care over the course of that person's lifetime.
Hmm. Does the report include any kind of proof of these allegations? I mean, what's the data that's being examined to come to these conclusions?
Yeah, the report itself does stipulate that its data that it found is foundational and limited, and that further investigation is required in order to actually prove the allegation. So right now, there is no current proof. And the Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., along with Vice President Vance, did refer the list to the DOJ and the Attorney General for further investigation. And it's up to them to open an official investigation and potentially subpoena hospital records to know if those patients were, in fact, even transgender to begin with.
Is it clear whether that's going to happen, whether there will be subpoenas and a DOJ investigation and all that?
That I do not know. Based on the just broad move against transgender people from the Department of Justice, it wouldn't surprise me if that was the next move, but yeah. I do not know.
Yeah, nothing set in stone or moving that way yet. You talked with a doctor who contributed to this report, or you or your colleague, I'm not sure which of you did. Who is that doctor and what did he say?
Yes. So Sam Hendrickson was the one who spoke with that doctor. And it's my understanding that most of what that doctor said is just that the reports of what they found were like red flags. He said that it's not definitive proof, but he did add that there doesn't seem to be, in his mind, any other plausible explanation for why someone might give the unspecified endocrine disorder diagnosis and prescribe that particular drug to people over the age of 12 without having that gender identity related diagnosis or precocious puberty diagnosis. And we talked to, that was Dr. Aaron Cariati. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but he is a physician and he did contribute to the report.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that the report also accuses a couple of Planned Parenthood locations, organizations in Ohio. What does it say Planned Parenthood did?
Yeah. So Planned Parenthood Southwest Ohio region was accused of submitting insurance claims for hormone replacement therapy for minors the same day that they were diagnosed with gender dysphoria, which doesn't typically happen if you're diagnosed with gender dysphoria. You usually have to go through a longer process before you could actually get that type of treatment. But the big red flag there is that it's illegal to prescribe those medications to minors in Ohio. And obviously the provider, Planned Parenthood, denied that claim and said that they do not provide gender-affirming care to minors. And then the other accusation against Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio was that a provider associated with their clinic gave a minor a prescription for hormones. And Lauren Blauvelt, the chief external affairs officer at Planned Parenthood, said in an emailed statement that the inquiry is, quote, a false political attack designed to intimidate providers and distract from the real health care crisis facing Ohioans and all Americans.
What can you tell us about how much gender-affirming care costs and how that compares to other health care costs? Because it sounds like the accusation is that this was all about the money and all the money that these providers could make from committing this alleged fraud.
Yeah. Well, the report says that about 225 medical institutions and providers are culpable in this fraud, earning roughly $60 million for prescriptions over the course of 10 years. The average annual cost of gender-affirming care is a little over $1,000, like per insured person, and that's according to the National LGBTQ Plus Healthcare Alliance.
Is that like per year?
Yes, the annual cost, my bad.
And
KFF estimates that healthcare spending per capita was more than $15,000 per person annually in the U.S. in 2024. So obviously $1,000 compared to $15,000 is not a large share. And that's for the most part what certain providers and professionals in the healthcare industry have said in previous years. During testimony against Ohio's transgender care ban in May in 2023, a doctor from Cincinnati Children's said that gender-affirming care doesn't provide a financial incentive, and said that in many cases, reimbursement is pretty abysmal for that type of care.
I guess because of the mental health care that can be a part of all that?
Correct, yes. Mental health care for people with gender dysphoria is pretty common, and that usually does not get reimbursed very well. So just to kind of put that in perspective, Nationwide Children's made about $4 billion in revenue in 2025 alone. So obviously, even if they were responsible for all of the $60 million worth of alleged fraud from 225 different healthcare providers over the course of a decade. That's still not a very large share of their profit. And Cincinnati Children's also collected $3.5 billion in revenue. So what the report is saying is that these patients are starting off with like hormone therapy, but then they go on for, say, like more intensive interventions such as genital reconstruction surgeries that changes a person's external sex organs, and that can cost an average of like $25,000. But in comparison, a gallbladder removal, which is a very common procedure even in children, can cost roughly $45,000. So even in the big scheme of procedures, genital reconstruction, which is pretty rare, only 3 to 15% of transgender people go through with genital reconstruction. And those people make up about 1% of the population. So those surgeries themselves are pretty rare and do not pay nearly as much as a gallbladder removal procedure, for example.
Interesting. Have you spoken with any other doctors about this report?
Yeah. So Sam did speak with Dr. Chris Bowling, who is a retired pediatrician from the Cincinnati area. And I believe he's also testified before the legislature regarding the specific issue. And he said that this report kind of simplifies or oversimplifies care for this population and kind of erases intersex people, which are people born with sex traits that include hormones or sex organs that don't fit a binary female and male pattern, in order to back up those allegations of fraud. So there's still a lot that we don't really know about gender-affirming care and the impact of gender dysphoria and what that might mean for the endocrine system. But he said that essentially the Department of Health and Human Services and the Trump administration feel like they know how these kids should be treated, and that it's an attempt to deny the existence of transgender people.
Well, we will keep watching to see if there is legal action as a result of all this. I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer Health and Environment Enterprise reporter Esther Lonstein. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy May.
Up next, why state lawmakers are taking aim at flock cameras. This is Cincinnati Edition. Flock cameras have been around for years in Ohio, but now a couple of state lawmakers have legislation in the works that takes aim at the license plate readers. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about that legislation and other news from Columbus are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Welcome back, Karen and Sarah.
Hello. Hey, always good to be here.
Great to have you both. Karen, I want to start with the flock cameras. Tell us about these bills in the works to regulate flock cameras.
Well, we're still waiting to see them. The two representatives, the Republicans who have sponsored them, there's a Republican representative, Levi Dean from Xenia, and then Republican Senator Al Catrona from Canfield. They want to put some more regulations and rules on these automatic license plate readers. It's not just flock cameras, though those are the ones that are getting most of the attention. And there are about 6,500 flock cameras in the state of Ohio. There's also already a bill that would try to put some rules on the use of those cameras by third-party individuals, not government entities. And that bill it was proposed by, interestingly enough, a former state trooper. And that bill has not yet moved. And that's going to be the issue with these two from Representative Dean and Senator Catrona. The legislature is not scheduled to come back until after the election. There isn't a whole lot of time to move. So I'm not sure exactly what kind of regulations will be put forward because of that. But both of them want to see more rules. And that's been the complaint that people have had in communities, that they just don't feel like these flock cameras are appropriately regulated. They're concerned about basically 24-hour surveillance and how the data is being used. I mean, in Columbus, it was reported that about 15,000 hits on flock cameras were used, the network that Columbus participates in was used about 15,000 times to track potentially immigration-related issues. There's concerns about, you know, abortion laws, things like that. And so privacy advocates have been talking about this for a long time, saying that there is a real concern here if you don't put guardrails on how these cameras are used and what happens to the data that they collect, then you're going to have real issues.
Well, these cameras have been around for many years now. And as you said, people have been complaining about them and raising concerns about them for a while. Why are these lawmakers interested in regulation now? Has it just reached a boiling point?
I think that's exactly right, that it's just reached kind of critical mass here where you've got communities that are actively passing regulations that would stop the use of flock cameras or automatic license plate readers or restrict them dramatically. And so people are the groundswell of support to do something about them is definitely building up. And I think, you know, there's the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio, has, along with the National Union, has started this campaign called Get the Flock Out, where they're trying to shut down these cameras. The ACLU wants all of these cameras to be shut down entirely because they feel that it's a violation of people's privacy rights and infringes on their civil liberties. But when I talked to the ACLU of Ohio's legal director, Gary Daniels, for our TV show, The State of Ohio, this weekend, he said he understands that people aren't ready for that yet. And so guardrails and regulations are important now, but those advocates would like to see those cameras completely turned off at some point.
I know you said that Representative Dean and Senator Catrona are both kind of still working on their legislation, but what can you tell us about what their specific legislation would do as they envision it?
Well, Dean told my colleague Joe Engels that his bill would allow police agencies to use the cameras for investigations if they get a warrant, which is one thing that the ACLU has specifically said they want to see. Dean's bill also potentially would ban the use of flock cameras from being used by governmental entities and police departments, whether at the state or local level, when it comes to artificial intelligence. And Senator Catrona is concerned about third-party companies storing the information. And in his bill, the information can't be stored for more than 10 days. So there wouldn't be this, you know, massive archive of data that I think some folks are worried about. So we're still waiting to see those. And, you know, Governor Mike DeWine has said that he thinks flock cameras are important for law enforcement. They can help solve crime. They can track missing people and stolen vehicles. But he has said that there should be some regulations. That would be something he would want to see.
Well, flock recently changed its own rules, as I understand it. Is that not enough for these lawmakers?
Oh, I don't think so. And again, I think that it's the groundswell of opposition to these cameras. And the fact that some of these flock cameras in different communities around the country are being stolen, they're being vandalized. And you've seen some widespread protests over these public hearings. Columbus just had one not too long ago where various groups came out to advocate against the use of flock cameras, or at least advocate for some regulations. And it's one of those issues that brings together a lot of different groups that might have different opinions, but the idea of constant surveillance has become a real issue for a lot of folks. I mean, certainly we walk around with cell phones, and so we are in a way being constantly surveilled, but the idea that there could be cameras basically all the time, anytime you leave your house, and, you know, even could drones be used to look into your house, you know, the worries about what is the next step here.
Well, thank you for that, Karen. I want to talk to you next, Sarah. We've talked on this program about the thousands of Haitians in Springfield who lost their temporary protected status last month. That means they can't legally work, right?
That's right. With the loss of that TPS or temporary protected status, the legal work authorizations that many Haitians had also went away, meaning that many jobs have had to lay off those within their workforce who were, on temporary protected status.
And hasn't the state recently announced new jobs coming to Springfield?
Yeah, there are certainly new jobs coming to Springfield, and state leaders are most notably touting Electra's announcement that it was going to build a headquarters and manufacturing facilities. Electra is another aviation company, so Ohio's seen a lot of these aviation and even defense aviation companies moving into the state. But Electra has said it'll add about 2,000 jobs in Springfield.
Wow. Well, the state's U.S. senators have spoken out about this recently. Here's Senator Bernie Moreno.
So we are going to see a big, huge boom and bonanza here. We'll make sure those jobs go to American citizens.
And here's Senator John Husted.
I think Springfield is now a city that's on the rise, despite all of the things that it had overcome.
Sarah, tell us more about their perspectives on this. Are they kind of implying that Springfield has been struggling?
I think a little bit. You know, there's a lot that's been said about Springfield's workforce and Springfield's economy, especially as attention was paid and drawn out to that Haitian workforce. But it's certainly in contrast to what Governor Mike DeWine has saying. He's credited some resurgence that has been seen in Springfield, some economic resurgence, to in part the Haitian workforce, and that factories were able to fill workers by pulling from some of these folks who are here on temporary protected status. And he's been outspoken about the fact that losing that labor could cause an economic downturn. But those, you know, those interviews you just heard with Senator John Husted and with Senator Bernie Moreno paint a different picture. They feel that there's not going to be a downswing in Springfield, and that really they feel its brightest days are ahead.
Are there two very distinct Republican responses to this in terms of whether, you know, they talk about the Haitian immigrants as a drain on Springfield or as people who are contributing to the community? Is there an origin for that? Those two different, very, very different perspectives?
Yeah, I think of it more as a spectrum as I've been covering this. Governor Mike DeWine has found himself maybe a little more almost siding with folks on the left on this issue. Many Republicans in Ohio have fallen into two different buckets from DeWine. I would say some of the Republicans who have interviewed about this issue fall more in line with how Bernie Moreno has spoken about temporary protected status. And if you remember, in 2024, Moreno campaigned on ending temporary protected status for not just Haitians, but many groups of immigrants who have come here on TPS. He feels that it's not a proper way for immigrants to come in because it's temporary, and that they should be seeking out other pathways to become a citizen. And if the conditions are right, they should go back to their countries of origin. And I should say the temporary protected status was created for immigrants from countries who are fleeing either war or natural disaster. Of course, in this case, folks in Haiti are probably fleeing a combination of both, because Haiti has been rocked by political insurgence as well as certainly environmental disasters. But Moreno has campaigned on ending it, and now he says that time has come. There are other Republicans more that I've heard, like Senator John Husted, who say, well, the law is the law. And now the law is that these folks are no longer legally able to be here. So maybe not as defensive of pulling that temporary protected status like Trump and Moreno have campaigned on, but still not speaking out against it. DeWine has really found himself kind of, I would say, alone among Republicans in speaking out against taking TPS away.
And remind us again how big the Haitian immigrant population is in Springfield.
Yeah, it's hard to get a true picture, especially because there is an estimation that some folks have self-deported maybe to South America. So we don't have a great picture at this point. But by local estimates in 2024, when, you know, this first was kind of hitting national news, there were some 12 to 15,000 immigrants estimated to be living in Springfield. And in Ohio, in total, there were estimated to be about 30,000 Haitian immigrants on temporary protected status living. Also in Columbus, there's a pretty large Haitian population. And of course, some of these folks have been here for a long time. Haiti has had TPS or had TPS for some time. So there were certainly some folks who have worked to full citizenship.
Okay. Well, Karen, I want to come back to you. Tell us about the case brought to the Ohio Supreme Court related to Ohio's constitutional amendment on reproductive rights.
Well, there are two cases that were filed by people who oppose abortion, trying to overturn the 2023 constitutional amendment that voters approved that guarantees reproductive rights and abortion access. One of those cases is in Butler County. That's still working its way up to the court. But then the other case was from a Youngstown area judge, a Trumbull County Common Pleas and Juvenile Court judge named David Engler. He is a Republican. He filed a lawsuit claiming that the amendment took away his authority when it came to parental notification and minors seeking abortions. And so, interestingly, he sued Republican Secretary of State Frank LaRose and then Attorney General Dave Yost, both of whom were strongly opposed to that constitutional amendment. But he said they were the ones who approved the ballot language. And so that's why he sued them. Well, the court was unanimous in this. So that's kind of unusual. Six Republicans and one Democrat all voted to dismiss and not hear this case. And so that's just, I think, kind of interesting here when it talks about, you know, the court being in agreement on this. But there's certainly a lot of other court action that will be related to the abortion amendment, most of it from pro-choice and abortion rights advocates.
Did the justices explain their decision?
No, this was a very brief thing. And, you know, Ohio Right to Life leader Mike Gonadakis says, hey, this was dismissed on procedural grounds, not on the merits of the argument. So he says that there's still room for somebody to come back and do something else. And both he and Abortion Forward spokesperson Jamie Miracle are saying that they look forward to some of these cases actually coming forward, because you've got several abortion rights groups and individuals who are trying to overturn laws that they say are in conflict with the constitutional amendment. For instance, the 24-hour waiting period, the ban on telemedicine being used for abortion-inducing drugs, the requirement that fetal remains be buried or cremated. They are challenging those laws, saying that they are unconstitutional based on that amendment, but those are still working their way through the courts and will eventually end up at the Ohio Supreme Court.
So how are advocates on both sides of the abortion debate viewing this decision and all these future legal challenges? I mean, does this still make the state Supreme Court a pretty important place for all those arguments?
Oh, absolutely. I think the court will be asked to decide a lot of these specific laws, and in light of the constitutional amendment that voters approved in 2023, there was already the ban on abortion after 6 weeks, the so-called heartbeat bill ban. And that's not expected to come back to this Ohio Supreme Court. It's permanently on hold after being struck down by a Hamilton County judge in October of last year. So that's the one that it seems like there is some resolution on. But some of these other cases, there is still litigation that's going forward. And there are also other bills that have been proposed. For instance, that waiting period has been proposed again. And, you know, some of these laws are, if they do get struck down, lawmakers who are very opposed to abortion want to try a different angle to see if they can still keep some of those provisions and restrictions around.
Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Happy Friday.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.